Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
This is The Guardian.
Defence capability. Why do we want a stronger defence capability? It is not to propel towards conflict. It is not for warmongering purposes. It is not certainly because we want an arms race. It is to deter. And why is that important? Because that deterrence, our contribution to collective deterrence now in the region, is doing what? It's making adversaries, is to make them think twice about undermining international law, undermining human rights, undermining the trade and security frameworks that benefit Australia.
Hello, I'm Paul Karp, Guardian Australia's chief political correspondent. Today in the Podcave, we have Labor MP Peter Khalil, who is the chair of the Parliamentary Joint Committee on Intelligence and Security. I wanted to speak to him today because it's the 20-year anniversary of the Iraq War, and his expertise before entering Parliament was and is security policy on Iraq. We'll also be discussing the AUKUS nuclear submarine acquisition, Julian Assange, and his committee's work on ideologically motivated violent extremism. Welcome, Peter.
G'day, Paul. Thanks for having me. It is quite the cave in here. It's warm too.
No one can hear you scream, but yeah. And so for people who may not know your professional background, can you explain, you know, where you were working when the Iraq War was declared and what your experience was through the war?
Yeah, I was a public servant with the Department of Defence at the time, and I got posted to Iraq in 2003. I was with the International Policy Division at the time, and I got posted to Iraq for about a year. And, even at the time, I was against the war. I thought it was a strategic mistake. It ended up also being a humanitarian disaster. In public, I was on the record around that. But I think it's probably important to point out that all the ADF personnel, defence officials, security officials, diplomats who were posted, whether they agreed or didn't agree with the decision of the government of the day, they went and did their work, and they fulfilled their obligations in that respect. And the work that I did was around rebuilding the security services, but also working on the restructuring the public service, the National Security Committee of Cabinet, the cabinet structure. So I worked with the new Prime Minister and the ministers and so on. And also I did a fair bit of work on demobilising militias, which is not easy. If people know the history in Iraq, there was a lot of conflict between various sectarian groups and militias, but I worked with the Kurds and the Shia militia and the Peshmerga and the Sunni tribal leaders throughout my time there to try and get them to stop fighting each other and to join sort of official security services and the army. So it was, it was a difficult time. But I think too, even those who opposed the war and the decision to go to war, once Saddam Hussein had been removed, there was an obligation on those coalition countries to help rebuild that country because they had been responsible for the removal of that regime. And so that was a lot of the work that we did, in that context of actually rebuilding the structures, if you like, of a state.
So no sort of internal conflict for an opponent of the war to find themselves in that position then?
No. I mean, there's a lot of things that you do when you're a public servant that you don't agree with. That you might not agree as an individual with, a decision of government, but you go ahead and it's like a lawyer, right? Like, you have to defend. Defence lawyers are actually important in the system, even though they're defending sort of odious people or whatever. But I think there's been a lot of discussion this week about the decision the Labor opposition made at the time, which was a very brave decision by Simon Crean to oppose the war, but he still supported the ADF personnel came out, and I think that was a really significant moment where he said, you know, we oppose this intervention, this going to war, but we respect and support you as ADF personnel and the sacrifice that you're making, the service that you're doing. And I think that was a pretty brave step by Simon at the time as Labor leader.
What are the lessons from the Iraq War, and do you think Australia has learned them?
Yes, well, there's a number of them. I think the attempts made to intervene in countries and shift them into a democratic system without having the baseline structures in place. And what I mean by that is a democracy is not just an election. Democracy is much more than that. It involves civic society, having a really strong civic society, a free press, an independent judiciary, checks and balances on the executive and the power of the executive with the parliament, a system whereby you can root out corruption or highlight corruption, accountability, transparency, and civilian control over the military, which is a very important principle. So democracy doesn't come when you go to a ballot box. There's a whole ecosystem, if you like, underneath that. And that wasn't there, frankly, in Iraq because they were under a dictatorship for a long time. Although having said that, there was a very well-educated, cosmopolitan population that had been there over the decades and a great civilization and history. You know, this is Mesopotamia, remember, so the cradle of civilization, frankly. So this is not to say that the Iraqi people themselves were not capable of this. What I'm saying is that they were under dictatorship for a long time and some of those baseline structures were not there or had completely dissipated. There were patches of time where they had democratic governance and so on throughout the last century. So I think that's one of the big lessons, and the interventions by the US and the West generally to try and push democracy, as we all know, was very patchy at the best in changing countries across the region. In fact, I think throughout the so-called Arab Spring, only a few countries have remained democratic out of that period. Lebanon's in a lot of trouble now. Iraq is still struggling, although it is still a nation state. It's still intact in that respect. We've seen what's happened with Afghanistan, for example. And that, I think, has a lot to do with, the Americans, for all their good intentions, just understanding that, you know, winning a war against a dictatorship, it doesn't mean you've won the peace. And so that was really, and a lot of people died in that conflict. But of course, a lot of people died from at the hands of insurgents and terrorists who killed Iraqi people because of their sectarian background. Whether if they were Shia, for example, a lot of the Sunni extremists killed them, Kurds, and so on. It's horrible. And war is horrible, and you don't go to war unless it's absolutely necessary. And that's, I think, the other lesson, which I know this is a debate that has been an ongoing one about when we make a decision to send our forces to a conflict, how does that work?
Yeah, so picking up on only going when it's absolutely necessary, and you mentioned at the start of your answer there, checks and balances, would it have made a difference if Parliament had an input into the decision? Last week, Paul Keating credited Labor and Simon Crean for having got that big call right, but we know that, John Howard and the Coalition committed us to war anyway. So should Parliament have had input, and would that have made a difference?
So this is so just take away the example. What we're looking at really is a question around how the executive and the Parliament and what their responsibilities are in relation to each other and to the Australian people when it comes to the deployment of forces, our forces. And that, as the Prime Minister and Deputy Prime Minister have said, that is the most serious decision that any government can make, to deploy forces to a conflict or to an operation. And so the power is invested in the executive, which is the government. The executive has the power to make those decisions, currently speaking. And there's a debate about whether the Parliament should have more input into that. There is actually a parliamentary inquiry into this very question with the Joint Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Committee looking into the questions around war powers and whether there should be more in the Parliament. My own view on this, it's a bit complex because I think the Parliament should have more say in the strategic decisions we're making and the strategic choices. The question around deployments, though, is a difficult one because you don't want to have a situation where you're making it, you're pre-notifying around ADF deployment. There are security implications to that for the forces themselves that may compromise their safety, the personnel, the operational security, the intelligence around it. That would have unintended consequences and kind of go contra to what you're trying to achieve if you're trying to, for example, do an operation that quickly supports a country in need, for example. I mean, I think of the example when I was working as the National Security Advisor, the Foreign Policy Advisor for Kevin Rudd, when there was the assassination attempt on Ramos Horta and Guzmão. You might recall, some listeners might recall that. That had to happen really immediately. There was no time for Parliament to approve a deployment of forces to help evacuate effectively the President and the Prime Minister in East Timor to safety and take on those rebel forces in East Timor that were, attacking the government effectively. And I remember I got the call at 2 or 3 in the morning from the Defence Chief and the Prime Minister. Everyone woke up and, it's kind of, you've got to make those decisions and the executive has the power to do that. And I think it would be, for example, that's a good example where if you had to wait to go to Parliament, when's the next sitting week? Mm-hmm. That's happening now. And thankfully, Ramos Horta, his life was saved by that operation. He was evac'd to Darwin and Guzmão as well. So that's just one example. But I think the Parliament, there is a space, I think, for the Parliament to actually express their views when it comes to big strategic issues and choices and even deployments on a sort of a broader level. But I think the executive still maintains that power to make the decision. And after all, it is the elected government of the day through the parliament, so it is representative of the people in that respect.
So not on the decision to go to war, but on strategic choices. So what about, should there be more parliamentary input into decisions like AUKUS and the nuclear submarine acquisition? Because something that struck me with the trilateral announcement is that Joe Biden has to get approval from his Congress to give us all this kit for the nuclear submarines. But the Albanese government can commit us to this without, is Parliament going to get any input into
so
that?
You're doing a contrast between the Westminster system of parliamentary democracy and the model of Congress and President, a republic model, which are quite different in the way that the powers vested in the Congress to check the President, much different than the fact that we have their Prime Minister and our ministers that are elected representatives of the Parliament as well.
That's why they're different, but should a Westminster system have more input
question.
Into
yeah,
like, into,
that,
into
that's
AUKUS
a good question.
Like,
that is a really good question because, okay, so first of all, my bias is the fact that I'm not on the executive, so I'm always going to argue that the Parliament should have more power and more engagement. I think the Parliament plays a really important part in our system with, the independent judiciary, the executive and the Parliament. These are the sort of big three pieces of our system under our constitution that check each other and balance each other, frankly, and protect minorities and all the rest of it. So I think, yes, on principle, the Parliament should be engaged more in that discussion, that engagement. But also it should be said that the parliamentary role largely is legislative, is to pass laws. So through that context, when we're looking at legislative reform, those debates can happen, those choices can happen. But that's where you see the distinction with the executive that makes decisions on policy or elected as a government to make decisions on policy and then execute those decisions. Parliament doesn't have that function of executing effectively. We do have committee systems that are very robust. Like I'm the chair of the Intelligence Security Committee that has a lot of responsibility with respect to our intelligence and security agencies, but not operational powers. And you noted the Congress there. It's a very different system because the Senate, the US Senate Intelligence Committee, for example, actually has oversight over some of the operational projects or what do you want to call them, the actual operations of the various intelligence agencies in a way that we don't. It's a very different system. We're actually going through looking at obviously the oversight powers of our committee and where we are doing our job and how we can do it better. And I think that's an important part of the Parliament's role. I would think, though, that the executive still retains the power in the Westminster system to execute policy. If you can't really have Parliament starting to execute policy, our job as parliamentarians is to debate laws and come to a conclusion about passage of law.
Mm-hmm. You were quite critical of Paul Keating for being willfully blind about the military build-up by China, but he also argued at the National Press Club that, even if you think China is a risk, that nuclear submarines wouldn't be the right solution anyway. Yeah. Do you think he was off the mark about that as well?
Well, I mean, the short answer is yes, but I will preface this by saying, you know, Keating is a hero of mine and I have great respect for him. He was a great Prime Minister and all of his achievements as Prime Minister can never be, you know, taken away. When you talk about his strategic analysis, he does downplay, when I say he's willfully blind, he does downplay the changed strategic environment. He argues that it's more benign than it actually is. All of the evidence before him is quite clear. The militarisation of the South China Sea, the economic coercion that we've seen, you know, the other aggressive behaviours to diminish, you know, the international rule of law, the human rights issues when it comes to Xinjiang and Tibet, the suppression of democracy in Hong Kong, that's all happened in the last 5 years. I don't think any analysts can you know, hide from that. Yet he does downplay that to the extent that he thinks that is not really, an import into that changed strategic environment. The fact is, it is not the benign environment of the 90s. It is a volatile strategic environment. There is a contest between authoritarian regimes and democracies around the world. In fact, some democracies that are being undermined from within, there's some illiberal democracies, frankly, we've seen that. You can even argue the Trump administration was sort of in that category because they undermined some of the trade framework of international law. And so with respect to his argument about the submarines, with all that sound and fury, Paul, not you, Paul, the other Paul, Paul's, all the sound and fury of Paul Keating, in the end, when he was asked by Laura Tingle, what should we do instead of the nuclear submarines, his answer was, oh, we should have 40 to 50 Collins-class submarines. Now, let's set aside the cost implication of that, of investing in a diesel submarine for the next 30 years. The difference in capability is stark, which has been outlined by a lot of people. The Virginia-class submarines and the SSN AUKUS, which will be built in Australia with the UK and the US, when they come out, will have capability that far outstrips the Collins class. But why do we need that capability? So this is the other question. Let's talk about this cost.
He was arguing it was trying to pen China in over there rather than keeping more submarines to prevent, you know, a land invasion over here.
No, but this is kind of, you know, that old saying that, you know, amateurs do strategy and professionals do logistics. We can play around in that sandpit, but the reality is this. Defence capability, why do we want a stronger defence capability? It is not A, to propel towards conflict. It is not for warmongering purposes. It is not certainly because we want to, you know, an arms race.
It's to deter.
It is to deter. And why is that important? Because that deterrence, our contribution to collective deterrence now in the region, is doing what? It's making adversaries, whether they be state actors or non-state actors, frankly, because there are many non-state actors that attack our systems as well and disrupt, is to make them think twice about undermining international law, undermining human rights, undermining the trade and security frameworks that benefit Australia. You know, the fact is we're a trading nation. We rely on a system or a normative international framework that allows that countries abide by so that we can actually trade with each other, which goes to our prosperity. That's the kind of world we want to live in. It's also a world in which might is not right, where a large country can just invade a smaller country with no consequence. So that's what we're trying to deter. We're deterring the conditions for conflict and confrontation. And see, on the other hand, what I thought was sort of with Keating was that when he went and attacked our foreign minister and kind of downplayed the achievements of soft power through diplomacy, because this is the other part of it. Mm. You can do really good diplomacy and an independent foreign policy from a position of strength. People forget that, you know, when they say to me, oh, why can't we have a more independent foreign policy? I'm like, I agree. Like, for decades, we have sat back and relied on the US to be the security guarantor of the region and, you know, maybe spent 1.5% of GDP on defence, which has allowed us to do what? Spend on healthcare and education and everything else for Australia to have such a great standard of living, because the Yanks basically looked after everything. That world, we don't live in that world anymore. We actually have to make a contribution to what is a much more volatile strategic environment. And you can do that with a strong defence capability that deters adversaries, makes them think twice before they decide to use force to achieve their strategic ends.
Right.
Now, we can have an argument about what that investment should be and what you get out of it. And that's a technical argument about submarines and what they do and how they do it. and whether it's worthwhile investing in that. But it should be noted that when the media gets all, you know, hyper excited about $300 billion plus,
this is a figure.
Yeah, it's out past 2050.
Yeah.
If you took any line item in the budget, you'd be looking at $1 trillion or more. It's actually 0.15% of the defence budget on GDP. It's about 10% of increase in the defence budget for that investment. And it's also investment in infrastructure, workforce, retraining, skills, the whole lot, which the PM and the Deputy PM have talked about a fair bit as well. But we do have to, as a nation, discuss the strategic choices that we have. So the last thing I'll just say about that, though, is when Keating talked about using the, buying 40 to 50 Collins class, now my dad gave me his 1977 Turana in 1991 when I turned 18, showing my age. It had already done 495,000 kilometres. I'm not still driving it today.
I think it was 40 or 50 conventional, not secondhand, and it's the Virginia class that might have the secondhand used label attached to them. But I wanted to ask, commentators have invoked Iraq during the AUKUS debate. You know, the concern is that 20 years ago we signed up to a war based on false intelligence from the US. And what's to stop us getting too closely hitched to the US strategy in the Indo-Pacific and ending up at war in our region?
Well, there's a couple of parts of that question to unpack. The first is this assumption that by engaging in a tripartite or AUKUS capability agreement, that somehow that's a strategy. It's not, okay? Australia has its own foreign policy strategy and its own defence policy in the sense that, you know, when people say, oh, you're joining AUKUS, you're giving over your strategy to the US, it couldn't be further from the truth. It actually allows us to, from a position of strength with our defence capability, engage in diplomacy. And that is exactly what Penny Wong has done. In 10 months, she has reset relationships with every Pacific country to make us the partner of choice with them, but on a basis of respect, not paternalism like the previous government, not arrogance like the previous government, but engaging them on issues that matter, like climate change, on cultural exchange, on economic relationship, on defence cooperation. That's real foreign policy. And Keating was way out of line by criticising the foreign minister.
That's Australia and the Pacific, but what about Australia and the US? Is there not an expectation that we would join in a conflict that this nuclear submarine is designed to deter, but if it doesn't work out that way, we'll be drawn in?
Well, first of all, the decision that we were talking earlier about, any decision an Australian government makes, and it could be any government at any point in time in the future, is up to the Australian government, whether we engage or deploy forces in that. But by improving our defence capability, that does not tie us into or force us into making any or pre-decisions, if you like, at all. It just gives us better capability and more advanced capability so that we can add to that collective deterrence so we can avoid confrontation, avoid conflict. And the diplomatic work that I was talking about, it was not just the Pacific because it's been across Southeast Asia and it's been with China as well. We've the first time in 4 years where we've had a meeting with the Chinese foreign minister and with the defence minister. That hasn't happened for 4 or 5 years.
I asked Mr Keating about that and he called me naive to think that that would make any difference, the slightly better relations with China. But
Why would he say that to you? You got off a bit scot-free because other journalists copped it a bit harder, I reckon. but I think why is that naive? The whole point is to engage with China and avoid the conditions that would create confrontation. And we want to have an economic relationship with China. We want to avoid confrontation. But there's no mistake that after some of these capability decisions are announced, for example, 18 months ago, China, after the first AUKUS announcement, when the shadow cabinet also went through and agreed to AUKUS, China pushed a member of the CPTPP, the trade negotiation. So when you're coming from a position of strength, it does lead to options that are diplomatic based on trade and so on and so forth. I think you've got to see it in the sense that it's not just about defence. It's diplomacy, it's development assistance, it's defence, it's the three Ds really of statecraft that have to combine.
And so I guess we need to have a culture of independence from the US, and you don't think that buying the submarines affects that. You've got to...
What kind of car do you drive, Paul?
Toyota.
Yaris. Are you going to do everything that the Japanese CEO of Toyota tells you to do?
No. Well, but I don't. I don't. Other countries can make engines. I think it's pretty unique a reliance on them in terms of being able to operate the technology.
Do you know how much of our defense capability we buy systems, technology. We import from all parts of the world. That does not mean that operational control resides in the country or the vendor.
Right. Okay. A week ago, we could have said, you know, oh, Paul Keating hates it, but, you know, it's just him. But now it's Paul Keating, Gareth Evans, Doug Cameron, Peter Garrett, Kim Carr, Bob Carr, Josh Wilson, who this week became the first sitting Labor MP to express some doubts. Was Keating's read that the Labor membership is going to hate this when they find out about it? Was he right? And where do you think this is going? Do you think opposition will grow or die down?
I think it's actually a good thing, by the way, that we are having a debate. I actually think that's important in our democracy because a lot of people are complacent about these things. It's out of sight, out of mind. I don't want to, you know, think about it. Actually, it's good to be able to engage in a discussion about our choices going forward, and because it does affect the future generations and Australia's future, really, in the region, our place in the world. So I think there's a benefit in that of luminaries like these, you know, former foreign ministers and ministers and prime ministers putting out their views. I think that should be welcomed, frankly. They're entitled to those views. I don't have to agree with them. I agree with some things that people say. I can disagree with others and base my argument on a rational response and argument. Josh, for example, is a great friend and colleague of mine. I mean, just to be clear, he's raising issues around proliferation and our work with the IAEA, and he's entitled to do that. That's up to him. You know, and you know, the response to that, for example, is the Director General of the IAEA was here last year, went through in the fine-tooth comb our verification and our safeguard mechanisms and the fact that we would be compliant with our obligations under the NPT. And it's worth repeating again because, you know, people don't know all the details. This is about nuclear propulsion, not nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. It's a sealed reactor, which for 25 years... there will be decisions around what happens to it after that, but it's the same decisions we're making too on other nuclear waste with respect to medical equipment and so on that come out of Lucas Heights or need to be stored or moved or whatever it might be. So,
do you think members will go along with it in the same way that MPs have, though? Like,
are you about the Labor Party membership?
Yeah, the Labor Party membership.
Well, it's sort of a tight old term, but it is a broad church, or it's a diverse group of members. Like people, every individual have their views. I don't know what polling is being relied on to assume what the Labor Party membership view is on AUKUS, for example. I haven't seen any polling myself. I talk to a lot of members. I talk a lot of my community, and people have varying views on this. You know, some talk about, well, we should have been looking at the French boats or Japanese, or that's a good. It's good to have a debate. Or, you know, some people don't want us to increase the defence budget. That's entirely acceptable to have that conversation. My view is that we do need to have some defence capability that gives us the opportunity to deter, you know, the possibility of conflict and confrontation and to protect that international rule of law, which has served us so well. And I think this is the important way that we do this.
Mm-hmm. Moving on topics now, you're one of the parliamentary friends of Julian Assange. We know Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has said that he's raised his case personally with the US government. How do you think that's going? Have you got a progress report from the parliamentary
well,
friends?
On that friends, Andrew Wilkie has done a power of work in this space as well. Many other members of Parliament right across the board, crossbenchers, independents, minor party members, Labor and Liberal, National. And, you know, from my perspective, look, I just for transparency's sake, I've engaged quite a bit with Julian's family members, his dad a couple of times, but certainly his brother, Gabriel, who's kept me informed. And I've, you know, tried to do some things behind the scenes, which is best not to, you know, talked about on radio. Is this a radio or podcast?
It's a pod.
Podcast. But my motivation there, I think, is just to explain it. I'm a strong supporter of that fundamental principle of a free press, which you'd appreciate as a journo. And so that's the sort of context of Julian with respect to Julian's case. You're right. The PM has said enough. Like, this has gone on too long. And the other thing that is really important to note is that in an era where I was saying earlier that democracy is under threat and everything that democracy means, which includes a free press and freedom of expression, and it's under constant threat by authoritarian regimes and constant disruption, if you like, that freedom of the press is critical. That's my view. And the Assange case is kind of sort of in the middle of that to some extent. And the ability of the press to hold governments to account, to hold us as parliamentarians to account, to question and to get the transparency, shine the light is for me really, really important. So sometimes we'll make mistakes and you'll expose that, and that's what you should do. Sometimes you'll call out, you know, decisions and whatever it might be. So that's a really important part of our democracy, and that's sort of the basis of...
That's why your heart's in it, but how do you think it's going?
Look, I think there's been some progress. We did a message direct to President Biden as a group, calling on him to drop the charges. And I know, look, every consular and other types of diplomatic support are being provided as much as possible. The Attorney General has been very, very outspoken about that as well. This is working through the US system as well. So that this is a decision that is both White House and Department of Justice. So
is part of the problem that he's fighting extradition, he won't go to the US and plead guilty? There's a school of thought that says that he should do that and then get pardoned rather than try and fight the system. I wonder if you have a view about that, about whether that's what the US will require order to show clemency to him.
I don't think he wants to go to the US. I think the family has said, and the supporters have said, that he wouldn't want to do that, frankly. So the effort has been made to try and drop the charges so that he's not forced to be extradited, right? Look, I don't know. This is a really hard one, Paul, because it's one of those sort of unique cases that's very complex in many respects. The other person got a pardon from President Obama, and that's what I think supporters of Julian are seeking, a pardon from... Well, maybe not even a pardon, but certainly to drop the charges, and then that would be a pathway out. But you'd have to ask the family whether they thought that was an option of going and facing trial in the US.
Hmm. There was some debate this week in Parliament about banning Nazi symbols. Peter Dutton said that he asked the Parliamentary Joint Committee on Intelligence and Security to look at this in 2020. And Attorney General Mark Dreyfus, he said he's asking his department to look at it. Is that something that you think is likely to come back to your committee soon?
It may. I wouldn't say no to looking at that, but we do have a very intense workload. We're looking at the Foreign Influence Transparency Scheme, temporary exclusion orders, you know, the IGIS bill, which is the Inspector General of Intelligence Services, terrorist listings. It's a very, very full deck of work to review legislation, statutory review, bills, you know, inquiries on radicalisation that may come back to us as well. But again, if that does come to us, we'll do our due diligence and our work in looking into that. I know that the Victorian State Government is moving in that direction, and take off my hat as chair, as a Labor member, you know, fully support the Premier when he says there is no place for Nazis in our society. Unfortunately, there is a growing number of far right wing groups and activity, which is deeply concerning. And these groups, just to be clear about this, no one's under any illusion that banning the Nazi salute is going to resolve this problem in the medium to long term, because there are deeper structural issues here. The rise of the far right, whether it's in Australia or other democracies, you know, without going into great detail, but there's socioeconomic issues, there are inequality issues, radicalisation of young people to those violent, hateful ideologies of fascism. And remember, this is an ideology that was responsible for killing 6 million Jewish people, millions of others based on their identity, handicapped people, disabled people during the time, gay people, people of different ethnic backgrounds, people of faith who were objectors to the Nazi regime. It is a terrible ideology that killed millions. And these groups now, the neo-Nazis, they manipulate issues, if you like, to try and they pick on minorities. And this is, we've got to be aware of the way they operate in that sense. And I think it's really important that governments address the sort of core issues here. It starts with education as well, really important. You want to prevent radicalisation at an early age where young people are captured by these groups and go into that little that rabbit hole, if you like. And yeah, as I said, the intelligence security agencies have noted publicly that this is one of the largest threats that have risen over the last couple of years.
You mentioned manipulating issues. We saw last weekend in Melbourne the Nazi salute being used by a subset of attendees at an anti-trans rights rally in Melbourne. You know, what's going on there? Why were they attracted to that cause or want to associate themselves with that cause?
I think if you got to go back to first principles on political activism or protest, right? Why are you there? Why are you protesting? If you're there because you want to push for a fairer vision of society around anti-discrimination, justice, social justice, particular cause, but if you're achieving the opposite, you really got to ask, and if your attempt at civil dialogue through protest is one which attracts neo-Nazis to your protests, you really got to reassess your approach, don't you? Like I'm very supportive of the right for free, to protest and freedom of association. This is a right we should not take for granted. In many countries in the world where you cannot protest, that's a really important right. But you really got to question when neo-Nazis are attracted to that protest, what your approach is.
What do you think about the categories of ideologically and religiously motivated extremism? I know there was a lot of debate when the terminology changed about moving away from the descriptor of right-wing extremism. You did mention the far right particularly being on the rise. Do you think that those terms understate the threat from a particular section of politically motivated violent extremism on the far right?
This whole debate around terminology is a very complex debate, because how you label something is actually quite powerful and important, but also labels and terminology can be limited. It's hard to capture everything or capture the different things. So people use different terms. Some people say far right, some people are, as you said, religiously motivated, ideologically motivated, and so on. Part of the religious, on the religious side of things, is because if you just use the term Islam, that, you know, people, you know, the assumption there is that, you know, you're talking about a particular religious group. I mean, you could have to do it for all the other religious groups as well. You start going down a rabbit hole as well, on you'd have to name them differently all the time. So religiously motivated was sort of flowing from that. Look, I think the complex bit about the far right or the extreme right or neo-Nazi, I mean, you could say things like fascist. That kind of covers quite a lot of groups, the white supremacist groups and so on. But it's a difficult one. It's a curly one. More importantly, though, Paul, I think the impact on our social cohesion from these groups, the way that they manipulate issues, pick on minorities, whether they be Jewish or Muslim or trans communities or LGBTQI plus communities broadly, or ethnic minorities, migrants, is really disturbing, because what it does is it seeks to sow division and hatred and rip the community apart and tries to destroy our social cohesion. I've, you know, for a long time fought against this. I've been a Victorian Multicultural Commissioner. I've supported the strength of our diversity as a nation. I've experienced racism firsthand. Listeners can't see it, but I'm a person of colour, Egyptian background. I've experienced racism directly. Living in Australia, growing up in the 70s and 80s was very different than now. I actually even remember a confrontation between a lot of the sort of ethnic groups and some skinheads in the 80s. So, you know, that was back in the 80s. There was a lot of that cycle going up and down of fascist groups and so on. So this is personal as well, and I really want to make sure that we do everything we can to try and unify the community and accept the difference and the diversity that we have as a strength of our society.
You mentioned a few references to your committee about radicalisation. What is the committee's work in terms of combating ideologically motivated extremism?
There was an inquiry that the 46th Parliament, the committee was under, was going through on radicalisation and extremism, which may, it's up to the minister whether they refer that to us. It's their call. But if they do, we'd be looking at continuing that inquiry with public hearings and engaging with stakeholders and coming up with recommendations for government to deal with those issues. And that could be right through the policy gamut as far as the recommendations go. With, and I don't want to preempt it because I haven't even finished it, but or started it really, or restarted it. But looking at education, looking at community engagement, looking at the way that security intelligence agencies engage with communities as well is really important. And the importance of this to our identity as Australians and who we are. When we were talking earlier about those groups, let's call them those groups, those extremist groups, all of them have one feature in common, which is that they seek to divide by identity, right? And that is destructive at its core. And they will use violence to do that and so on. We're pushing back against that with a concept or a view of our society that is united or that accepts diversity, not just tolerates it, but embraces it as really important part of who we are. What does it mean to be Australian? I struggled with this growing up as a migrant, with a migrant background. People are telling me to go back, the old go back to where you came from. Like, mate, I was born in Melbourne. Like, where am I supposed to go? Mm. So if you're a migrant, you constantly question who you are and your identity, and you don't take for granted being Australian. I love being an Australian. I'm proud of being an Australian. I think it's a great privilege to be a representative in our parliament, in our democracy, to represent my constituents and a very multicultural community in my electorate of Wills. You know, some 60% are from other parts of the world or have a parent from another part of the world. So, you know, we should never take that for granted, but there is a question about Australian identity and who we are going forward, and we should engage in that.
Mm-hmm. I think that might be all we have time for. I'm not sure if we can solve all the world's problems, but I certainly understand them better for the benefit of that conversation. So thank you very much, Peter.
Thanks, Paul.
This episode was produced by Mel Chun. The executive director is Miles Martignoni. The Canberra team will be back with another episode of Australian Politics next week. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloan Stevens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloan.
Support comes from ServiceNow, the AI platform for business transformation. You've heard the hype around AI. The truth is, AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow is the platform that puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/AI for people to learn more.